This is Bertha's World, sponsored by Hecma Press. Episode 2, How Did Bertha Get the Money? If this is the first time you are listening in and wish to know more about the context to Bertha's travels, you may wish to listen to the trailer in Episode 1. Otherwise, I hope you just enjoy the story. When readers first hear about Bertha, they sometimes wonder, how did she get the money to fund all the things that she did? Well, the comical story is what this episode is all about, and it takes place on the outskirts of Cape Town, South Africa. There are many local phrases and words in this episode, and I will read the commentary at the end of the story to explain and contextualize them. And now on to the episode. King of Carps, Cape Town, South Africa. They waited for spares at the first bus shelter on Victoria Road, exactly where he told them to. The Hanachis, he called them. The police called them the Fat Boys Gang, although in truth only one of them was fat. Ayer was fat. Was, because the police shot him. You cannot miss him, ja, the German tourist said about Ayer. He meant, of course, that they wouldn't miss seeing him. Ayer was one of the fattest people he had ever seen, but mainly the police misunderstood him, or maybe Ayer did point a gun at them. The police told News 24 that the German man was lost. Never take the shortest way on Google Maps when you're in South Africa, yeah? He later wrote on Facebook. And stop to ask for directions in the Bonjour Café at a total garage between Grassy Park and Plumstead. This was an unfortunate decision because the garage was also where the Fat Boys met Middleman, who sells to the Snyman to drop off a month's supply of tuck. They were waiting for nearly an hour for Middleman by the time the German man stopped his BMW two parking bays away, and Ayer had been moaning all this time. Spares had grown tired of it and instructed him to get out and get some fresh air. Standing under a milkwood tree, Ayer watched the German man pacing up and down between the parked cars and the patch of dying cocoonia grass, all the while complaining loudly into his cell phone. After a one-sided negotiation, Ayer helped himself to the man's fancy sunglasses and wristwatch, and his iPhone, and the man fled into the Bonjour Café. He didn't have to wait long. The police were fast, they usually are when there's a tourist being mugged on the Cape Flats. Spares was furious and told Bertha to get the hell out of there without Ayer, who was still going through the contents of the man's BMW. If he was going to be a beep and rob a tourist in daylight, then they weren't going to wait. And so, Ayer was stuck. The police found him easily enough, hiding behind the black tips growing on the edge of the garage parking. From that moment, Spares really trusted Bertha. He always thought she was a solid auntie, and having an auntie was a good thing. Bunch of carpies driving around Cape Town on trouble, but having an auntie as the driver made all the difference. He also liked that she came from up north, Tanzania or Malawi somewhere, not a local scholly, which meant she sounded educated, less carps. What really impressed Spares was how she followed orders. When he told her to floor it out the total garage, police sirens wailing in the background, she drove like a crazy woman, eyes like a cokehead tourist. Mason said she looked like a tsotsi caught in the crossfire. She could handle pressure and Spares liked this girl. No way was she a snai. After Ayer was shot, the Fat Boys had to find a different place to meet Middleman. New place was perfect, the old apostolic church in Grassy Park, out of sight, and Mason's mother ran the Meals on Wheels at the church, so there was always a good reason for them to be there. Bertha maneuvered the VW Polo under a tree behind the church. Is this okay, Jerome? She always called him by his real name. Spares was something the heavies used. Caleb said he wouldn't mind who called him Spares was the name the kids gave him at school on account of the size of his head, but Bertha associates it more with his habit of treating everyone like a spare part. She didn't want to use that name. She didn't want to be a spare part. Business was booming and Spares was smiling. Middleman was the second dropper for the day, and it wasn't just tuck anymore. Fentanyl, benzos, coke and ecstasy for the rich kids, rhino horns and pangolin scales for the Chinese, and for the first time, a crate of freshly harvested perlimoon waiting in the trunk to be dropped off in Paro. The Chinese love that stuff. The briefcase, heavy with cash the spares received for the first drop-off, was safely tucked under his seat. The box packed with tick and cocaine rocks gently between Caleb and Mason at the back. Even without air, it was still a squeeze, but Spares refused to get a bigger car. "Don't get flash," he said. "That's the first step on your way to jail." Metal Man drew up beside them and let his window down. He opened the briefcase on his lap to reveal banded stacks of euros, dollars, and rands. Mason craned forward to catch a glimpse. Caleb handed the box beside him to Spares, who pushed it through the window. There's an extra brick just for you," Spares said, tapping the lid of the box and making a squelching sound with the side of his mouth. Metal Man took the box and passed the briefcase to Spares. After nearly a year of faithful transactions between them, there was no need for further discussion, and Metal Man was gone less than a minute after he arrived. "How much?" Caleb blurted out. "How much in rands?" said Mason, still leaning forward between the two front seats. That was, after all, what the term of their cut. "Shut up, you two," Spares was irritated by the same questions every time. He opened the briefcase and caressed the bundles arranged neatly in rows, each one secured with an elastic band. He plucked the two stacks of 100 grand notes from the case and tossed one to each of the men at the back. "That's at least 10 grand each. Don't do anything stupid." He placed the briefcase beside the Glock that lay within easy reach at his feet. "Let's drop these two clowns and go see the king." Bertha drove in the direction of the McDonald's, where the two Hummaches always celebrated payday with a cheeseburger meal. "The king? You're going to see the king with her?" It took Caleb a few minutes to grasp the gravity of Spare's last statement. "Yes, this auntie's good for business. It hasn't gone unnoticed that the cops hardly stop us anymore, and that means fewer bribes," said Spares. "The king wants to meet her. Maybe it's time for a promotion," he giggled, and pushed Bertha playfully on the shoulder. "Lucky you," said Mason. "He controls this whole show. Grassy Park is his territory." "He's the king," affirmed Caleb. "The king of cops," Caleb and Mason chuckled. Bertha pulled into the McDonald's parking and turned off the engine. "Cops?" she looked at Spares. "Yes, that's us," he said. "Don't you know? We're all carpies." "The cursed cops," Mason said mockingly. "Screwed from all sides." "Too white for the blacks and too black for the whites," added Caleb. "God forgot about us. Why else did we end up here at the beep end of the world?" he mused, and shooed Mason out the car. "King gives you work, and if you act right and he trusts you like he does this auntie, you can go far," Spares reminded them before the door slammed shut. "I'm going to take a beep," he said to Bertha. "Wait here." He pushed the Glock into the front of his jeans and covered it with his shirt. Bertha followed the movements of the three men through the glass front of the McDonald's. Spares entered the toilet while Caleb and Mason pointed at the brightly colored menu behind the woman wearing a frilly white hairnet at the counter. Bertha saw them seat themselves at a window in line with the car. Her gaze drifted to the briefcase on the floor, and she thought about the second case beneath the seat. She reached down and pulled it out, placed it on the passenger seat and flicked open the latches. Rows of 100 denomination euros and American dollar bills were squeezed into its interior. She quickly shut the case, placed it beside the other one on the floor, and returned her gaze to the two men sitting at the window. Caleb was watching circumspectly. He said something to Mason and stood up, exited the McDonald's and walked slowly in her direction, a scowl creeping over his face. Bertha saw Mason bustling Spares out the toilet. He was frantically buckling his trousers. Bertha seized the moment. She started the engine and thrust the car into gear. Caleb broke into a run. He knocked furiously on the window as the car lurched forward. "The Kent will cut you, you dumb beep," he screamed, saliva spraying out the window. Spares raced out, snatched the Glock from his trousers, and fired a shot just as the VW bounced over the curb and disappeared. Bertha kept going, past Athlone and onto the M7 North, focused on getting as far as possible from the mayhem that was unfolding behind her. Spares will be alerting every one of his heavies in Grassy Park, as well as the private security on King's payroll. Any minute now and they'll start looking for her. And they had faster cars and guns, lots of guns. First they'll comb Grassy Park and then fan out on the highways, guessing correctly that she will have chosen to escape north, either up to Namibia or maybe in the direction of Joburg. Where else could she go? They have to get off the main road as soon as possible. After they covered Drassy Park, they will be racing in her direction, no more than 15 minutes behind. Bertha exited the M7 near Malmesbury and took the quickest route to Paternoster. Despite being way off the main routes, it was a minor tourist attraction, and being a foreigner there won't raise any questions. Half an hour later, she entered the tiny fishing village. She drove the length of it, noting the last of the whitewashed houses with a guest house sign plastered above its brightly coloured door. The road angled down to a rocky beach, and she stopped the car on the shoulder. She opened the trunk, lugged the crate onto the rocks and tipped its contents over the edge. A gentle splash, and the paralawim disappeared into the darkness below. Bertha returned to the guest house and parked around the side of the building, out of sight of anyone passing along the road. The sun was a flaming disk, already kissing the deep blue on the horizon, and it cloaked the house in a rusty orange hue. An elderly woman emerged from the front door and strode towards Bertha as she climbed out the car. "Am I right in guessing there may be space for a few days?" Bertha said as the woman approached. "Yes, and you're welcome." The woman spoke slowly and flashed a broad smile. "I'm Bess." "Thank you," said Bertha. She reached in and grabbed the two briefcases. "Any other luggage I can help you with?" No, thanks, said Bertha. "Light traveller." "I see. Sometimes it's better that way." "Follow me," said Bess. "I think I'll give you the beach cottage. You will like it. Very isolated, and it's got a lovely view of the ocean." Bess led Bertha down the coarsely gravelled path lined with protea bushes that grew proudly in the sandy soil. "You sound foreign," said Bess. "Where are you headed?" "I'm going to Joburg, and we'll probably just keep going north after that. I thought I'll take the quiet roads through the Karoo, maybe stop at a few towns. Colesberg, it's an interesting town." "That it is. And you're right, I'm not from here," said Bertha, "which reminds me, would you take dollars, euros, maybe?" Bess paused for a moment. "Sure," she smiled again. "That will be just fine." They stopped at an arched entrance covered with bougainvillea, leading out to the deck of the small house. "Here's your cottage," she said. "You didn't tell me your name." "Bertha." "Bertha, how nice," Bess said. "You know, I think we're going to be friends." That's the story, King of Cups. And some of the words in there that you might not have heard of are Gamachis, which is a derogatory name for someone of mixed race in the Western Cape region of South Africa. Cups. Cups is interesting. It's the name of a group of people as well as the language. It's also sometimes called Afrikaps, or more colloquially, Kapital. And it's a language spoken in the Western Cape of South Africa. In this episode, King of Cups, the following terms are slang and found in Cups or Afrikaans and often used in other African languages. For example, snai, which means snitch, auntie, which is aunt. The words that I cut out with a beep, they are vulgar insults. Squally is a petty criminal or a troublemaker. The word paralamun refers to abalone, which is often found in the Cape region and trafficked to the Far East. The word snaiman is a slang term for a drug pusher. It's quite comical because snaiman is a common Afrikaans or Cape's surname, and it's used as a drug dealer because the preface snai means to cut, as in to cut a line of cocaine. And turkey is a methamphetamine dragged in parts of South Africa, especially Cape Town, and it's stereotypically associated with gangsterism in the region known as the Cape Flats. And the word tsotsi is a generic word for a criminal in Southern Africa. It's probably of Sotho origin, but it's found in most languages and certainly used in most of the languages in Southern Africa. Now, just the commentary at the back of the book from King of Cups, a little bit about the Cape's language. The Cape's language has its roots in the 1500s and emerged as a language amongst the Khoisan, Malay, Indonesian, Malagasy, and African communities, many of whom were enslaved by Dutch colonists. And they used their own creolized version of Dutch, which included words from their own languages, to keep conversations private. Karps, interestingly, was later sidelined for sociopolitical reasons, but it's still spoken by millions of people, sometimes pejoratively called Karpis. But what's interesting is that linguists consider Karps a unique language because it's historically and culturally distinct from Afrikaans, which emerged much later. They seem to be sister languages, and there's a trilingual dictionary of the Karps project, and there's a reference in the book to that. It's important to mention in this story the long and complex and sometimes very painful history of the mixed race community in South Africa, because it provides a backdrop for some of what the characters say in this episode. The Karps label is usually substituted by the apartheid term coloured for people of this community. The term coloured, however, is rejected, therefore, by many in the community. You may wish to see an article by Dennis Kreewagen in the Daily Maverick, 29 September 2024. There's a reference to it here. And with respect to what Caleb says about being too white for the blacks and too black for the whites, readers may also be interested in an article by Ismail Lagardin, also in the Daily Maverick, May 2024. And also his memoirs in a book entitled Too White to Be Colored, Too Colored to Be Black will be a helpful insight to what it means to be colored in modern day South Africa. There's a reference to that in the commentary here as well. Now, the Western Cape in South Africa is infamous for gangsterism. This may come as a surprise to readers outside the area who are frequent visitors to Cape Town, which is really such a tourist city. But the difference between the wealthy and the deprived areas is enormous. It's stark for anyone who visits there. The areas known as the Cape Flats are sometimes considered a hotbed of gangsterism, but of course this occurs everywhere in Cape Town and beyond. Gangsterism and organized crime syndicates in Cape Town are often associated with drugs like tick and snuggling, and the Perelmoen mentioned in this episode is commonly harvested illegally and shipped to Asia. But there are many other smuggled goods, from cigarettes to gems, foreign currency, animals or animal parts, like the pangolins and rhino horns that are mentioned in the story. It must also be said, apropos the characters, that the Cape Flats are often viewed homogeneously by non-residents. But the reality is very different. Cape Flats, in terms of human population, is one of the most diverse populations in the world. I also refer readers again to the writings by Ismail Lagardin and his article in the Vrye Weekblad, August 2023, From the Ottoman Empire to the Burqa, and there's a reference to that here as well. And most importantly, if you'd like to read stories by people from the Cape Flats themselves, there is a reference here to a website which documents some of those stories. So thank you very much for listening to this episode, and please do share and join me for episode 3, which I'll be recording in about 10 days' time, and I look forward to seeing you then. Until then, to quote from Ifialuwa from Perth's Law, be free to be from Perth Arinne.